Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Marty Moscowen. 7-year-old Zaymar Jones was playing with toys on his porch. It was a Saturday, August 1st, West Philadelphia. At about 7:40 p.m., neighbors say a man drove down the street and fired at people gathered on the block. A gunfight broke out, and in the end, Zaymar was lying on the ground, hit by a stray bullet. A nurse on the block immediately performed CPR. A police officer arrived and rushed him to the hospital. It wasn't enough. By that Monday, he was pronounced dead, 7 years old. Zaymar is more than one of 100 children under 18 to be shot in Philadelphia this year. In the days after the death, anti-violence advocate Colwyn Williams of Cure Violence spoke at a rally held on Zaymar's block.
My mom can't come out on porch. My child can't come out to play. We got all these organizations. Stop putting band-aids on situations that need surgery. We need the trenches.
On this hour of Radio Times, Philadelphia's deadly 2020. What's driving the violence? What can we do? We'll have two guests with us who will be there for the full program. Kendra Vandewater is co-founder of the youth outreach group Yeah Philly. She's also the director of the Interfamiliar Homicide Initiative at the Philadelphia Anti-Violence Partnership. Kendra, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Juwan Bennett, doctoral candidate in criminology at Temple University and co-founder of the school's Urban Youth Leadership Academy. Thank you for joining us, Juwan.
Thank you so much for having me as well.
Later in the show, we'll hear from Micaiah Taylor, who lost both a brother and a cousin to gun violence this year. First, though, I want to start with you, Kendra. We see the statistics, we're heartbroken by the stories, and we can't help but ask why. You're out there working with young people and trying to help victims on a regular basis. How do you answer that question? Why?
The why? So, yeah, Philly focuses on addressing the violence at what we call root causes. And so we think, you know, society believes that violence is, quote unquote, senseless or comes out of nowhere. But we work around giving people opportunity, lifting people out of poverty and making people have the support and the services that they need.
Juwan, how about your perspective on that? You work with young people as well, but you also study this as a criminologist. When you look at Philadelphia, what do you see as the underlying issue?
Well, first, I just want to thank Kendra for her amazing work with engaging in young people. And one of the problems that we see, I think we have to address it at the root causes. And there's no secret that the COVID-19 outbreak has really exposed a lot of things, especially in the inner city community. One of those things being mass incarceration, Michelle Alexander, she writes about this explicitly in her book, The New Jim Crow. But one of the unintended consequences of mass incarceration is that it removed a lot of the mentor and role male figures in the inner city communities. And so kind of using from a biblical kind of quotation there, Rose a group that knew not Pharaoh. So I think we have a lot of young people currently now who don't have those access to talk with people like Kendra and our organization, talk about gun violence, what does it mean? And currently, from a criminological standpoint, one of the things, you know, I've been really doing a lot of work with a group called the Youth Sentencing and Reentry Project. And one of the great things we've been doing is we've been pairing older males who have lived experience in the incarceration system with younger men who've experienced the incarceration system. And we've been having intergenerational conversations around gun violence, around health, around a lot of litany of issues. And I think in order to be able to address this conversation, we have to have intergenerational conversations and get back to those mentoring and really understanding what the harmful effects of as it relates to gun violence in our communities.
So you mentioned mass incarceration there. I mean, that's been a conversation that we've been having for decades in America. It seems, though, something different is happening specifically this summer. Kendra, I wonder if you can speak to that. Is it the stress of the pandemic? Is it other stresses, unemployment?
So I definitely agree with Juwan saying, you know, a big part of it is mass incarceration and loss of the mentorship and the role models. But yeah, I think the pandemic has highlighted things that people oftentimes ignore. You know, these issues are not new issues. People are becoming more aware of the lack of opportunity that people have. They're becoming more aware that families don't have their basic needs such as food and, you know, sustainable jobs and able to take care of families and also just mentorship and support. So I think that these issues have always been there. They're structural, and we need to start addressing them instead of trying to come back with a Band-Aid on things that have been around for years and people just have not been able to address them at the point that they need to.
I'm wondering, Kendra, if you can speak to an example of a young person you worked with or a situation you knew that could kind of connect the dots between kind of the larger economic issue and the problems that you're talking about and what ends up leading to a shooting.
Definitely. So we recently had a situation, a young person, he's 18, going on 19. He had called us in a panic and had said that he got into a disagreement. There was a misunderstanding between him and a group of people, turned into, you know, they were going to meet up, they were going to fight. And it turned into the group of people brought guns and they attempted to shoot him. So he called us in a panic. We, you know, went and got him, did a safety assessment and a safety plan. But thinking about, you know, if this person did not call us, would he have had another place to go? Would he have had someone else to call? And this person particularly, you know, he's in the age where he's still in high school. He's already behind. We have helped him address some barriers in terms of he hasn't even been able to get a state ID, background checks. He has not been able to get a job, and not because he's unqualified, but just because there's so many barriers to get these small things that seem small to us because we have them, but they're big things. And so, you know, we help pay and get the IDs, the background checks, set up interviews with him, but basically walking along side with him to make sure he has these opportunities because he has not been able to do them by himself. In another situation, he needs, you know, his family needs food. He needs consistent money and opportunities. So if we're not giving these people that support, then it turns into all of these things that often lead to a simple argument, which can be mitigated usually, turns into I'm going to get a gun and we're going to solve it this way.
And that's what it was in that case. It was a conflict that you feel like, you know, could have been avoided.
Definitely.
And you've been quoted as saying, you know, people, like you said, are not out here killing people for no reason. We talk about murder as a senseless thing. If you're in a war over drugs or guns, it ultimately has to do with money. So you do see that economic picture as the basic underlying cause for this.
Definitely. I see economics, but I also see that people are not taught the skills to be able to resolve their own conflicts. So we focus a lot on that aspect as well. And so when, you know, you're in the heat of the moment, managing emotions, if you are grown, if you grew up and don't have those skills that would help you resolve some type of conflict, you're going to act out of emotion and anger. And oftentimes, if these things are tied to your money and you're trying to survive and someone owes you money, you're trying to get your money back. Right. So it's definitely, to me, a lot of different factors, but definitely economics is a big one.
I should note, you know, the recession and the coronavirus lockdowns have disrupted a lot of our kind of community and cultural norms that are positive influences on all of our lives, right? School, church, and then there's been less access to rec centers and sports. Could you talk about, Juwan, maybe the effect that those institutions not existing in the ways that we're used to could be playing into all this?
Yeah, I think I'm just going to piggyback right off what Kendra said. I think it's really interesting. We don't have those resources, those key resources in the community. We see these inner conflicts coming into light. And so in criminology, we also there's a debate, a burgeoning debate, is it the kinds of people or is it the kinds of places? And you have a lot of place-based criminologists that say, if you show me what your schools are, if you show me what your community centers look like, I'll show you what your crime can look like. And Elijah Anderson does a very fascinating study in his book called Cold Street, and he does an ethnography. He sits and details what it's like to be in Germantown Avenue. He starts at the beginning of Germantown Avenue, works his way up to Mount Airy, Germantown, goes to Mount Airy and Chestnut Hill. And what you'll see is in those areas of Chestnut Hill and Mount Airy that are resource rich, you don't see so many problems with people having to settle conflict. They have, you know, formal ways to do that via police or different organizations that can step in. And then you see resource-deprived communities, or they call them social disadvantaged communities, who don't have the same access to resources. I know we're talking about a lot about defunding the police. And so in order to solve those conflicts, people have to use violence as a means of self-help to handle those situations, because those school, church, and other communities, resources in the communities are not, accessible to those individuals, or oftentimes not there. And I think that goes to Kendra's point. What we do at the Urban Leadership Academy is we work with youth as early as 5th, 6th, and 7th grade. And we continue to work with those youth when they finish high school to open up the college and career we call pathway. So a lot of people talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, that there's a pipeline that can lead one from the classroom to prison. And we believe the inverse can be true, that we can create pipelines to success. And so we have to think about how we create these pipelines for sex for our kids in the inner city communities, because unfortunately, these kids are very brown, intelligent, and have the know-how. They just also don't have the opportunity, and that comes with a lot of structural barriers.
I'm wondering, Juwan, what you think about then the debate over reopening schools in the middle of the pandemic, right? I mean, there's the health and safety aspect of it, but then there's just this fear that without more positive role models in people's lives and that structure, there's going to be other ill effects.
Well, I think that's an interesting debate. I think we have to take into safety as a concern. But I think the real question we have to ask ourselves about equity and access. And so there are schools, school districts that are not open in schools, but individuals still have access to laptops and still have access to school uniforms. So I think it's going to be really crucial in our city leaders to figure out how can we make sure that inner city kids have access to internet, and to make sure that we can still, programs like the Philly and programs like Urban Leadership Academy, even though we may not be able to meet in person, that we can still continue doing this program, whether it be via Zoom or other measures. And so the group that I run with the Youth Sentencing and Reentry Project, we actually don't meet in person. We meet virtually twice a month, and we have a call with about six older men who lived experience. We have young youth client partners, and we've been doing that work for about several months when the pandemic hit, and it's really been fascinating. We talk about life skills, we talk about conflict resolution, we talk about, we're doing a podcast actually this Saturday with the Citizen about gun violence and having an intergenerational conversation. So things can still be done virtually, and so we have to think about safety, but I think this virtual space gives us a different opportunity to think outside the box. And so things that we couldn't do in person, it's not a limitation. We can think outside the box and do those things virtually and still continue that programming that I think the children and the youth in our city need. Mm.
Kendra, we're coming up on a break, but could you speak a little bit about how the pandemic has affected the work you do?
Definitely. Same thing as Juwan. You know, we have to think about how do we engage people differently, because Yeah, Philly still does things in person. Like, we have our teen-led food bank every week. We understand that we cannot do every single thing online. We do have online things. We have video check-ins. We have video groups. But there are some teenagers. There's a base of teenagers.
We'll pick that up, Kendra, right after this break. That's Kendra Vandewater, co-founder of Yeah, Philly. We've also been with Juwan Bennett of Temple University Criminology. And we'll be back after this short break. Join us in the conversation, Facebook, Twitter, at Radio Times, or call us. Thank you. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about Philadelphia's gun violence crisis with Kendra Vandewater, co-founder of the youth outreach group Yeah Philly. We're also with Juwan Bennett, doctoral candidate in criminology at Temple University and co-founder of the school's Urban Youth Leadership Academy. I want to give a chance for everybody to join the conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Leave us a note on Facebook and Twitter at WHYY Radio Times, or call us at 1-888-477-9499. I want to give you a chance to finish your thought, Kendra, about how the pandemic is affecting the youth outreach work that you do.
Definitely. So, you know, a lot of people are doing everything online, and I think we have to understand that not all teenagers can engage well online. And so it's not for everyone. And Yeah, Philly, you know, it's impacted us in a way, because we usually do every single thing in person. So we still have some online things, but we've started doing some groups, like our youth and police curriculum is now in person. And we have a teen-led food bank every week because we know that people still need that in-person engagement and people also still need food. So we're going to give out food regardless.
Okay. Before we continue the conversation, I want to play a couple pieces of tape from mothers who've lost sons to gun violence in Philadelphia. First, let's listen to Tylin Davis, whose 21-year-old son, Robert Wood, was robbed, shot, and killed in June in North Philly. She tells the story of a bystander who rode with her son to the hospital.
When the cops got there, the young man rode with my son in the cop car for them to rush him to the hospital. And he looked in the young man told us, he looked in his eyes, and he told him, "Tell my family I love them." And he closed his eyes. So that was my son. That was our son's last words, was tell my family I loved them.
And let's hear from Kimberly Kamara, whose 23-year-old son passed away 3 years ago in a shooting in Germantown.
Each time you hear a story, you just can't help but to cry. Because now you know there is a mother out there crying for their child. It's different when it's your child that has been murdered. It does something to you different, and you either get up fighting or you just fall into a depression.
Both of those clips came from a story WHYY News reporter Aaron Moselle did this summer. Kendra, I'm wondering, when you hear these voices, what goes through your mind?
It's horrible. And, you know, we deal with families who are burying 2 and 3 children from gun violence. And so we're at a time where services and real solutions are urgent, and we don't have time to keep having meetings or keep doing the same things over and over when people in our communities are dying. And it breaks my heart to have to keep coming in contact with families who do not get what they need, and they keep having to bury their own kids.
And this clearly is a weight on families for generations, and you work with those families. Could you illuminate what that means for us?
Definitely. You know, this is generational. And so when you have families who lose people every year, sometimes in less than a year, there needs to be, from their perspective, what do we need to do? I think oftentimes we try to come up with our own solutions instead of making sure we know that these families are the experts, and also engaging the people who, you know, participate in criminal activity, or, you know, making sure that even those people who need services the most are engaged. And so I think when we talk about gun violence, you know, that's why I bring it up. It's not a senseless thing. It's tied to different things generation after generation, and we really have to start to address those things.
We have a caller here, James from Doylestown. I think we have you on the line, James. What's your question? James, you there?
Yeah, I'm right here.
What's your question, James?
So Kendra related a story, your guest, about a client who came to her and had a beef on the street, and the guy showed up with some illegal gun. So I'm wondering if she passed that information on to the police so that they could get those guns off the street.
Kendra, could you respond to that?
Go ahead.
Sorry. No, I didn't hear the question. Sorry. Go ahead, Kendra.
So the situation was mediated, and that information is passed on. But also, we do things differently, and we don't believe that police are part of being proactive. So there's just a different way that we do things. But yes, we engage with police. It's just in a different way.
When you say that, the proactive point you made, could you expand on that further? What do you mean by that?
Yes. So the history of police, you know, police are here to protect property. They're also here to come after a crime occurs. And yeah, Philly is looked at as prevention. So when we engage with police, it's more so around the violent nature of crime, but also understanding that we don't engage police until we believe that it's safe to do so, because police have caused harm with a lot of the people that we work with. So we're mindful of that.
I do want to talk about the political context that this is happening in. Jim Kenney took office as mayor of Philadelphia in January 2016. The numbers of homicides each year have gone up from 277, 315, 353, 356, and this year we're on pace for potentially more than 430 murders. I'll put this question to you, Juwan. What, if anything, should the Kenney administration be doing to better address this issue?
Sure. And I just want to comment on what Kendra said after we heard the mother's clip. She said something really important, what I thought, and something that I heard. She said it was generational. And one of the things that sparked me to actually be a criminologist, I'm from South Philly. I'm South Philadelphia native. I grew up at 26 and Tasker. And in my old neighborhood in 26 and Tasker, I actually lived right next door to a playground. And my mother would not let me or my brother ever go to the playground, which is on my block. I would see other kids ride their bikes because it would be drive-by shootings all the time. So until the time I was about 7 to 10, until we moved to our new neighborhood, I never played on the street, and I never played in our playground. And I always was interested in this interest of gun violence, in this interest of the community violence, and that's how I actually got to the PhD program. So I think we have to talk about it being generational. And when I was in high school, my best friend accepted his was killed in a drive-by shooting the same day he accepted his college acceptance letter. And the same thing actually happened. Oh, thank you for your concerns. And the same thing actually happened when my younger sister, she lost one of her high school teammates to gun violence. And she, when I was doing my PhD, she asked me, you know, what could she do? And she started an organization called Reach for Peace. So unfortunately, I think what the pandemic has showed us has spotlighted the ills that were already in the inner city. And I think it's highlighted when we think about gun violence, it's highlighted when we think about police brutality. And I think one of the things with the Kenney administration, I think we have to really think critically about how do we utilize the offices that are already there. I know people are talking about new strategies, and I think it's going to be really pressing on the Kenney administration. I know they have a mayor's commission on African-American males, and they have an office dedicated towards black male engagement. I think what they will have to start to think about is how that office can be more grounded in the community and how they can actually partner with city council to really fund those initiatives that plague some of the things that we see.
And we're talking today on Radio Times with Kendra Vanderwater of Yeah Philly and Juwan Z. Bennett, a PhD student at Temple University's Department of Criminal Justice. Kendra, I want to give you a chance to talk about what you see as the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of the Kenney administration on this issue.
So I definitely agree with Juwan in terms of utilizing people and offices who are already there. I don't think we need new strategies per se, but I believe that we need new people and new leadership. So if the Kenney administration engaged and evaluated and also helped to fund more community organizations who are on the ground. And this comes from me seeing the disconnect between the government and between the grassroots organizations. And so having these people at the table to not just be there, you know, for a meeting, but making sure that these solutions and these strategies are, one, cultural, because that's a huge issue. Two, funded. And a lot of times, you know, we talk about credible messengers and people that we hire, but we don't pay them well. So we can't expect people and violence interveners to do work that, you know, we don't even pay them a living wage for. So the Kenney administration definitely needs to engage more community groups, stand them up, evaluate them, the ones doing the real work and the ones out there having successful outcomes, and supporting them in a way that they can collaborate and work together on some real cultural solutions.
The other public official that we should talk about is District Attorney Larry Krasner. Took office in 2018 after running on a progressive agenda as a former civil rights attorney. He's ramped up a program that avoids jail time for people with gun possession charges. He's also pushed for reductions to the city jail population, with fewer people who can't afford bail being locked up pre-trial. And his critics say it's these reforms that are part of what's driving the violent crime surge that we're seeing. Do you think those criticisms are at all fair?
I would like to jump in here. I don't know if those criticisms are fair at all, because I think we have to really understand the context of the criminals. So one thing we have to understand is that most people don't understand that 95% of all people who become incarcerated are going to come back into the community. And even though we have 2.3 million people, I think, incarcerated. There's millions more people who what we call are in community supervision. So people who went to court and either on parole or even on probation. And so I don't think that we can conflict the two. I think sometimes there's apples and oranges. And so I think Larry Krasner has done a good job of people sitting in bail. And oftentimes people are sitting in jail for nominal bails. I mean, we're talking about things that are not thousands of dollars, but maybe hundreds of dollars. And so we are sitting people in very traumatic experience. And I think one thing we have to really ask ourselves when we come to the criminal justice population, we know as criminologists that there are about 5 to 8% of a criminal population that purport more than 50% of the criminal outcomes. And so we have to be strategic about how do we think about targeting those individuals. I know there's the violence interrupters and a lot of different initiatives, but I don't think we can conflict the two. And because individuals are coming home from bail and that maybe certain restrictions are relaxed, which should be, I don't know if we can say if that is driving the crime that we see now.
I want to get your take on that too, Kendra.
I don't think these are fair criticisms either. Philly has had a crime problem and violence issue before Krasner. And so I think people are just, as a society, they're not ready to have the conversation about how do we support people who commit these violent crimes. At the end of the day, just like Juwan said, most people who are incarcerated, they're coming home. So they're being incarcerated. When they come home, how are we supporting them to be productive citizens in society? How are we making sure that they're able to live a life that we say, you know, is quote unquote crime free? Because people come out and then we expect them to do all of these things like get a job or get ID, take care of a family, live on their own with no support. So I don't think these criticisms are fair. One person does not drive a violent crime, and it's definitely an effort around the whole city.
Got an email question from Avi. What is the chance that if Philadelphia schools would have been brought up to the resource levels of Lower Merion, swimming pools, stadiums, nurses, psychologists, counselors, teachers, the picture would look different for most Philadelphia students? And for this issue, I guess, is the implication.
I think the picture will look very different. I think people, I'm actually still on the board chairman for an organization called Herb Ed. They advocate for fair policies around the city. It's led by Jameer Harper, excellent, and it's all youth student led. And one of the things that we've been talking about is a fair funding formula. And we know that other school districts get funded at a rate which is not proponent to Philadelphia. I'll give one example, and I'll let Kendra take it. I don't want to take too much time. But we created Urban Youth Leadership Academy because we were trying to address the high school dropout rate, because we know high school dropout is one of the leading factors of how youth become engaged with the incarceration system. And we found that we start interacting with the two middle schools that actually sits on Temple's campus, and we went to go meet with the staff and the students, and we were wondering why students couldn't get into some of the select high schools. These kids were talented, they were smart, they were bright, they were doing all the great things. And we came to learn that the reason, in order to get into your special admit schools or some of the top tier schools like your Massaman's, your Gamp, your Central's, your Girl High, in eighth grade, you would have to have taken algebra and passed it in eighth grade mm-hmm. in order to apply. The problem is when you go to a traditional public middle school in the city of Philadelphia, they don't offer algebra in the eighth grade. So there's already a list of schools that you can not even apply to, limiting your options and your career choices. And so I think if we could start tackling some of those inequities, when I talk about equity and access, opportunity is not an opportunity if you can't have access to it. And opportunity is not an opportunity even unless you know it exists. And we found that even in these middle schools that they didn't know about these other schools in the city that could help them and would be interest into their educational trajectories.
Kendra, do you want to add something there?
Definitely. Yes, it would look completely different. And even just from my personal story, I grew up in Montgomery County. I went to North Penn High School. I got into this work because my experience from police brutality in the city and being a resident at a juvenile detention facility. But my education looked completely different than the education of a public school system. And there's no reason why it should be different. People should be learning in the way that they learn. And we have to make sure that all of our kids, every single one, has access to the opportunities that we believe will make them thrive in their lives. Hmm.
I do want to ask you before the next break about Police Commissioner Danielle Outlaw, who came to Philadelphia from Portland in February. WHYY's Amina Condi interviewed her on the night of the rally held on Zamar Jones's block a few days after he was killed. Here's what Police Commissioner Danielle Outlaw said.
From the police standpoint, I'll tell you this. Residents here will tell you that when we had a strong presence here and we maintained that presence, that things were okay. But the second we left, things went back to normal. So we have to figure out that delicate balance to where we're visible and we're present and we're close enough to where we can react in a timely manner, but we're not over-policing underrepresented neighborhoods as well. So there has to be a balance.
This seems to be the tightrope that we're having a national conversation about. How much police is enough or too much? Kendra?
We're definitely over-policed. I understand. I think this issue is also generational. I find that talking to older generations, they want more police. I find talking to people who are millennial age, a little younger, they want less police. So it's definitely a balance. You know, I live in West Philly. I live at 5900 block of Locust Street. My neighborhood is very over-policed. And the way people interact with the police, the way police interact with people is not good. And so, you know, it's a battle that's going to be ongoing. And we need to figure out a way that to have police do their job, but also not harm or cause further harm to our communities.
Juwan, 30 seconds, your answer before the next break.
Oh, I wish I could continue. We know we have an under-policing, over-policing paradox, so the tightrope and the tension exists. I think the thing that's going to be really helpful is that I think when it comes to police presence, I think people want the presence, but one thing is we have to change the metric of police, right? And so I think one of the things that we can think about is we want police to feel protected and safe, and not necessarily when somebody goes to a store to exchange money and it's thought about counterfeit money, that person has their knee on their neck.
That is Juwan Bennett, doctoral candidate in criminology at Temple University and co-founder of the school's Urban Youth Leadership Academy. And we're also talking this hour with Kendra Vandewater, co-founder of the youth outreach group Yeah Philly. We want you to join the conversation. We'll have more from both of them after a short break. Email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, or leave us a note on Facebook and Twitter at WHYY Radio Times, or call us 1-888-477-9499. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory in for Marty Moscowane. We've been talking about Philadelphia's gun violence crisis this hour. In a moment, we'll get back to our conversation with Kendra Vandewater, co-founder of the youth outreach group Yeah Philly, and Juwan Bennett, doctoral candidate in criminology at Temple University. But first, let's get the perspective of another family member struggling with the loss of loved ones due to violence this summer. On the line is Micaiah Taylor, Philadelphia resident and counselor with the ECO Foundation. That stands for Education, Culture, Opportunities. Micaiah, you recently lost a brother and a cousin to gun violence. I'm so sorry for you and your family, and I appreciate you taking the time today to share your story. We believe it's important to get it out there. Thank you for being with us, Micaiah.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about your brother and your cousin and what they meant to you?
Amir, he, a.k.a. Ski, he meant a lot to me. Like, he was out there doing stuff for the community. He's from West 58th and Master, near 59th, actually 59th and Master. He meant a lot to me, yeah. My brother, Dada, he's from Southwest around 66th Street. He got killed down Conestoga, but, like, he was, like, one of them type of young boys that if you need something, oh, I'm going to help you out, like, and I really miss them, too.
Can you tell us about how the loss has affected you and your family?
It affected me and my family, like, it hit reality real quick, so now I'm doing this thing is when I'm going to start doing stuff with my community.
And what do you see as a path to a better tomorrow? What's the way forward?
A better tomorrow is like I'm gonna start getting justice. Like these guns and stuff is like really hurting me, and I don't want to lose no more loved ones. So I want my loved ones to lose nobody else.
You think the issue is access to guns?
Yeah. Over stupid beef. It could be beef over a toothbrush. They're going to shoot you. Like, I don't understand. And being 14, like, it really hurts me. It hurts me a lot.
Yeah, I can understand that. I can hear that. I want to bring Kendra Vandewater and Juwan Bennett back into the conversation. Can you react to a little bit of what you heard there from Micaiah, Kendra?
Yeah, I'm so sorry, Micaiah. And you're talking about Sciano, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. It's just, you know, I don't know what to say, because there's nothing to say that's going to make people feel better. But I do, we work with people every single day, and I do just want you to know that there are people here to support you and who care, and there are people who want to do things about it. And so if you, you know, would like to be a part of that, and you have ideas that would help, like, we are all ears, because you're the expert in this work that we do.
Yes. Thank you. I would love to.
Juwan, I want to give you a chance to join the conversation there, too.
Yes.
Juwan, are you there? Oh, I think we might have lost... Okay, we might have lost Juwan there. That's okay. Well, thank you so much, Micaiah, for sharing your story. It really adds to our conversation today. I want to go next to a caller, Vince in Camden. You on the line there, Vince? What's your question? Vince, are you there? Vince, are you there?
Hello?
Hey, Vince, what's your
yes.
question?
Yes, I'm here.
What's your question, Vince?
Hi. It was really just more of a statement. I'm thrifty. So I really came to be an adult in the crack epidemic, 90s to 2000. I caught my first felony at 23, approximately. I bought an 8-ball of cocaine, and me and a friend were going to sell it. We got caught a third time, and I became a felon at around 23, me and him. Just approximately $62 worth of drugs. My life was altered, and as well as his. We should have gotten lawyers, but we were ignorant. And we just took a felony plea, and that was that.
And your son was affected.
3 years
too.
Ago, approximately, was murdered in Camden in an alley. He was on drugs. You know, sent him to rehab a few times. It didn't take. I told him if he came back from the rehab this time, he'd probably die in the city. And he left rehab, came back, and 3 days later, he was dead. I know everyone is sorry. I'm thinking about the next kid. Mm-hmm. And why can't we just legalize drugs and stop all the killing when you can still get an 8-ball of cocaine for $100? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, thank you, Vince, for your perspective. I really appreciate you sharing that, and really sorry about your son and your loss, and I appreciate you thinking about this on the larger level as well. Kendra, when we talk about solutions, when we talk about the way forward, what do you think it is?
So in terms of even just addiction, right? I know the city is really against safe spaces where people can use and harm reduction, and we're not there yet. But harm reduction works, and it works in other countries. And I think if Vince's son had a place to go that was safe, even though he was using, he may still be alive. And so the solution to me is, regardless who you are and what you're doing, you need support and you need a service.
And, you know, there are emergency hearings being held in city council this week. Councilman Kenyatta Johnson has called those. There's been these rallies that we've seen, like I mentioned, the atrocity with Zamar Jones. Kendra, you specifically said you did not go to that rally. I'm curious why you chose not to go to that rally.
I didn't go to the rally because, you know, these things that are happening, I think it's great that people are marching and rallying and having hearings. I'm at the point in my life where we've done that for a long time. And so we look at Yeah Philly as just a different way, being a part of the solutions and the conversations. So I didn't attend because I'm tired of having these same conversations. You know, we don't need to keep having emergency hearings about things that we've been having hearings about for years. And it's time for action, and it's not time to keep talking and having conversations about issues that we know have been here for a long time that we're ignoring.
So you're not very hopeful about what's going to come out of city council based on these hearings, it sounds like.
I'm not. Honestly, and until people start collaborating and working more with community organizations and younger voices, I don't see any change. Or, you know, I understand change is slow and it's a process, but we can't keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting things to be different in our communities. And we also don't have time to keep doing the same things over and over while people die.
And we've been talking a lot about city government accountability, but I'm wondering what you think about state government, federal government, if you have, you know, hopes for what actions would be taken at those levels.
Yeah, I think that they need to help fund our cities. You know, the reality is the pandemic has caused cities to be completely broke. We don't have the money to help stand up certain resources, but also the state and the federal government needs to help cities like Philly and all across the country to fund programs and to fund resources that address the root causes of violence.
We did get a question from Lauren via email. She writes, as a parent with the privilege of living in a safe city neighborhood, sending a child to a great public elementary school, I want to know how to help curb violence outside my neighborhood. What advice would you give Lauren?
I would say talk to people. I think that's the biggest thing we miss. You know, when these things happen or before these things happen, we are going to communities and talking to people on blocks that look like war zones where people never visit because they're afraid. And talking to your neighbors, talking to community members about what they need is the biggest thing that I think could make such a huge difference in how we assess communities and also make sure we address violence and what people need.
And Juwan Bennett, I think you're back on the line with us now, right?
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah, thank you.
I think one of the things she can do to help as well, I think one of the reasons why the George Floyd travesty was different from any other killings of unarmed black people was that the united stance and the voice. And so we need multiple voices and we need multiple allies in the struggle. I think the more voices, the merrier. And to kind of go off Kendra's point about why, our path forward, we need action. And I don't think we need another rally hearing, emergency hearing. And one of the things I would like to even add is, like, we want to see the policy changes. We want to see some initiatives put in place. And even from a criminal justice standpoint, the way we think about crime, the way we think about drugs, we're all better than the worst things that we've ever done. And we've known that these inequities have been around for some time now. And I think from local, state, and federal government, we're asking for those really swift changes that are going to address these things. When the pandemic hit, and with uncertainty and people were losing their jobs and we were losing people by the day, people stepped in to address this problem. And we have a specific problem in our inner city communities where people are dying every day, loved ones are dying every day, and we're still having to figure out what we want to do and what direction we need to take. And we need those supports from all levels of government and all hands on deck.
And when we talk about action, I do want to get both of your takes a little bit more concretely on this conversation around defunding the police, using some of those resources and putting them into other social programs. It sounds to me like that you're very much in favor of that. Kendra?
So I believe that police have a role, but I do, you know, I understand their equipment costs a lot of money, but I don't understand why, you know, the police budget is $760 million, but also our schools, our mental health services, our social service budgets are minimal and they're always cut. So I do believe that there is, you know, strength in both. And I believe the responsibilities can be different for each role, but we need to invest more in our schools and education and especially mental health and social services. And if we don't invest in those things, because leadership may not believe that they're essential to people thriving in their lives, then we're not going to see a change in our communities.
I should note that we did invite the Philadelphia police to participate in this conversation. They declined. We also worked and tried to get members of the Mayor Kenney administration into this conversation. That did not come to fruition either. Juwan, want to get your take a little bit more on that question of defunding the police?
Yeah, me and Kendra, I feel like we're kindred spirits, but I will say this. I think people are getting caught in the language of defund the police. Criminologists have been calling this for over a decade, and we've been calling a justice reinvestment, right? How do we take those money that we're spending on police and correction and take all that money that it houses the arrest people and house them in jail and spend on our education system? Just some really quick statistics. Growth in state general spending and funding adjusted for inflation from 1986 to 2003, we spent about 141% on police and corrections, and only 69% that money went to K-12, and only 5% went to higher ed. So I think when we talk about defunding the police, it's not about a system of lawlessness or recklessness, but we're talking about priority and prioritization. And so we have to, do we want to be a city or a government or society that's going to incarcerate or criminalize individuals, or we're going to think about other restorative means? And so I think we have to think about educate over incarcerate. And that's what we're really talking about, defunding. How do we divert funds and think about we can use that money to make a healthy person, or do we want to see that person in a long-term storage locker? I mean, it's our choice to make.
I want to take one more caller this hour. Marvin in Camden, I think we have on the line. Marvin, what's your question for Juwan and Kendra?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's more of a comment than anything. I was listening to Vince from Camden. I also grew up in Camden. And the conversation of family or single parenthood has not been brought up. And that is the major issue. There are no fathers in these homes. I grew up with a single mother that tried to raise two boys in Camden, in North Camden, and it just didn't work. After 13 to 14 years old, we knew we were getting beatings, but we still came in 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning because we wanted to do what we wanted to do. Now, if there was a father in the home, I truly believe that wouldn't have happened.
I want to, just because we're coming up at the end of the show, I want to...
More laws.
Yeah, I take your point, Marvin. I just because we're coming up to the end of the show, I want to make sure Kendra and Juwan have a chance to react to that. You know, we did talk about mass incarceration at the top of this show, which, of course, took many men out of many neighborhoods. But, Juwan, maybe you want to talk a little bit about what Marvin was getting into there?
Yeah, and I think Marvin is hitting the head, nail right on the head. And I think one of the unintended consequences of this idea of having men not being in the community, and we know significantly if you have an incarcerated parent that's in jail, it increases your likelihood of future offending and incarcerating very much significantly. And I have some colleagues, named Dr. Abigail Henson. She's at Arizona State University. She's done amazing work with called the FAT program. It's called Fathers and Children Together. And because we know this issue is so proliferated, they're actually is at Greatest Prison, which is now in Phoenix, which is right outside of Philadelphia, and they're actually helping men parent their children while they're in prison. So it's very, very important about this issue about having male figures. And we know that's not all of the problem, but it's one of the contributing issues.
And Kendra, you know, we're coming towards the end of the show here, so last 40 seconds from you.
Yeah, I agree with the Fathers and Children's Together program. There's a Focus on Fathers program that addresses the same thing. And if we don't start addressing mass incarceration, we're going to keep having to support, you know, men being parents from prison. But also the single family household is a big discussion. I was raised in a single family household. You know, my life was a different trajectory. And if my grandfather was not there and my grandparents were not there as a support, my life would be completely different. So it is about the mentorship and just the support, whether it be a community person, an uncle, an aunt. We need to make sure that the village is strong because not everybody is going to have both parents in the home.
Well, thank you. That was Kendra Van De Water, co-founder of the Youth Outreach Group, Yeah Philly. Also, Juwan Bennett, doctoral candidate in criminology at Temple University. Kendra, Juwan, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having us.
And also thanks to Micaiah Taylor, counselor with the ECO Foundation. She joined us earlier in the hour. Our engineer today was Diana Martinez. Radio Times is produced by John Ahrens, Debbie Bilder, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Marty Moskowin. Thanks for joining us.